commitment to democratic rules of the game. What Netanyahu did once he understood that he may find himself in prison is to get rid of those people and to substitute them and add others who are messianic and bigots and racist, no less than Smotrich, Ben Gvir, and their allies. So altogether, we can see a combination, a constellation of a prime minister who is accused in serious corruption charges, who's afraid as a coward, who is afraid of prison, together with messianic fascist bigots who think that the blood of human beings, Israelis and Palestinians alike, is the red carpet of the Messiah. So that's that combination actually created the genocide in Gaza that took place and they continued for 2 years at the expense also of the Israeli hostages and soldiers. That's the key to understand what was going on. And when President Trump dares say that Netanyahu should get a pardon, first of all, of course, he intervenes in domestic issues which are not his business. But on top of that, and in my view worse than that, is that he actually speaks the language of a mob, of the mob. He's not Tony Soprano, but he behaves as if he was.
Ofer Kassif, I want to thank you so much for being with us, member of the Israeli Knesset and Hadash Tal Coalition. On Monday, he and the Palestinian parliamentarian Ayman Ulde were ousted from the Knesset during President Trump's speech after the two shouted terrorist at Trump and held up signs that read, recognize
Palestine. I want to correct you, please. We didn't Palestine. Shout anything. We were totally silent. We didn't shout at all. We just held the sign. Recognize Palestine. That's it. We didn't shout. We didn't curse. We didn't interrupt. We kept silent.
And are you going to be allowed back into the Knesset, or were you expelled?
Who knows? At the moment, I am suspended anyway, until the end of December, because I dare say that there was genocide going on. It was forbidden to say that there was a genocide. But I appeal to the Supreme Court. Let's see what's going to happen.
Well, when we come back, we're going to Physicians for Human Rights Israel in Ramallah to talk about the Gaza doctors who are still being held imprisoned by Israel, including the pediatrician, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the director of the Kamel Adwan Hospital. And we hope to go to Gaza, which has lost internet connection, but we hope to speak with Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud. This is Democracy Now! Back in 30 seconds. Randy Weston playing the blues, performing the song when he spoke with Democracy Now! In 2012. To see our interview and his performance, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez. It's the War and Peace Report. On Monday, thousands of Palestinians gathered in Khan Yunis and the West Bank to celebrate the return of nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners freed as part of the ceasefire deal. Many were jailed by Israel without charge or trial, showing signs of starvation, medical neglect, and torture. Now there's mounting international pressure for Israel to release more Palestinians, including the pediatrician, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of Gaza's Kamal Adwan Hospital. He's been held under harsh conditions without charge since December, when Israeli troops stormed his hospital, claiming without evidence it was a Hamas command center. Soldiers forced Dr. Abu Safia out at gunpoint, along with patients he'd refused to abandon. There's famous footage showing him wearing his white medical coat as he climbed over the rubble to walk toward an Israeli tank before he was detained. Dr. Safia had continued his work even after an Israeli attack killed his son. He also suffered injuries. This is a Palestinian prisoner freed earlier in the year named Hakim, describing what Dr. Abu Safia had been exposed to in Israeli detention.
Dr. Hassam was beaten, especially Dr. Hassam and us, the medical staff, out of all other captives. They beat us, cursed at us, and starved us, and they started punching him. Are you the doctor? Come here. And they'd beat him.
Calls are also growing for Israel to release Dr. Marwan Al-Hams, the director of field hospitals in Gaza. For more, we go to the occupied West Bank, to Ramallah, where we're joined by Naji Abbas, director of the Prisoners Department at Physicians for Human Rights Israel, which in February released the report Unlawfully Detained, Tortured, and Starved, the Plight of Gaza's Medical Workers in Israeli Custody. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Naji. Why don't we start off with Dr. Abu Safia, and then just talk about how many doctors, nurses, hospital staff are detained in Israeli jails?
Good morning, Amy. As you mentioned in your words, Dr. Abu Safia is still detained, unfortunately. Him and beside him, we know about 19 doctors who are still in detention and weren't released yesterday. And also about dozens of nurses and paramedics who didn't get released yesterday. Why? We don't know yet. But they are still in detention without being charged officially with any offense.
And what about the plans now for rebuilding the healthcare system in Gaza? What do you think are the immediate first steps that need to be taken?
As we said from the beginning, the arrest and the detention of the healthcare workers, one of its goals for the Israeli army was destroying the health system in Gaza. The health system in Gaza now need every source that can help to rebuild this facilities, to help to rebuild the staff, and keeping these doctors, these nurses in detention is denying from the opportunity to rebuild this system.
And the people who are being released now, many of them have lost, have severe weight loss and are basically were almost starved while they were in captivity. What do we know about the deliberate withholding of food and water from Palestinian detainees?
That's it. We visited Dr. Abu Safia a month ago on the 25th of September. Our lawyer of PHRI, met him for the first time, actually, in Ofer prison. Dr. Abu Safia complained about being starved, about violence, daily violence in Ofer prison. He witnessed and described that he's suffering from medical issues and medical problems, and he's not getting any follow-up. He didn't meet a doctor for months. Actually, Dr. Abu Safia described that he, in the day of the visit, it was the first time that he received clean clothes after 9 months in the Israeli detention. It was the first time before our visit that he got a clean clothes. So we need to emphasize, we are not calling for the release of these healthcare workers just because they... First of all, because they unlawfully detained, they are not being charged. But second of all, because every one of them, the ones who suffer from health conditions, but even those who are healthy before the arrest, they are facing a very serious risk for their health and for their lives. They are being tortured. They are facing violence daily. They are denied from medical care, denied from their basic rights. They are being starved. They are disconnected totally from the outside world. They don't know what's happening, with the deal, if they are getting released, if they are not. They don't know their legal status, actually. They are not getting the opportunity to get a consultant from a lawyer. Their courts, they are describing hearings in the court that continue for 2 minutes, saying to them, you will stay in detention. You are not charged officially, but you will stay in detention. We don't know for how long. That's the status. So that's why we are calling for the release.
Nadia Abbas, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of the Prisoners Department at Physicians for Human Rights Israel. As President Trump celebrates the ceasefire hostage deal, major questions remain over what happens next. We'll look at the Gaza summit, and we hopefully will go to Gaza City, where there's been internet loss. Stay with us.
It may have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Hugo Chavez highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies, and which lady is crying over luxury's disappointment? So he goes over and he's trying to sympathize with her. But he thinks that he should warn her that the climate emergency is just around the corner, yeah.
Billy Bragg performing Waiting for the Great Leap Forwards in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Trump celebrates the ceasefire hostage deal at the Gaza summit in Egypt yesterday, major questions remain over the deal and what happens next. We turn now to Khaled Al-Gindi. He is visiting scholar at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies and advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Welcome to Democracy Now! Khaled, if you can start off by saying, what exactly was signed? We watched, you know, President Trump and the Egyptian President al-Sisi sign a document. What is in this plan at this point?
Well, I think the plan is like what we saw announced last week. It is very short on details, except in terms of, this very initial phase that hostages have to be released within 72 hours, followed by Palestinian prisoners and hostages, and of course, the cessation of hostilities. Beyond that, the document is sort of big on generalities and, vague statements about the need for peace and security and prosperity for Israelis and Palestinians. It doesn't say much, frankly. The president likes to talk about this plan as in very grandiose terms, ending a 3,000-year conflict, which, of course, is completely false. But there's a lot of fluff, frankly, in terms of the substance of the plan itself.
And Khaled Al-Gindi, nearly 2,000 prisoners were released by Israel, but there was one who was not released. Israel absolutely refused the request of Hamas to release Marwan Barghouti, probably the most famous of all the Palestinian prisoners that Israel's held, widely respected by all political groups. Why do you think that Israel was so insistent on not releasing Barghouti?
Well, I mean, they have consistently refused to release him, as you pointed out. I think the main reason is, like any colonial power, Israel wants to keep the people that they subjugate weak and divided. And of course, they are now. There is a 17-year division between Hamas and Fatah, between Gaza and the West Bank, and that has really crippled and handicapped any kind of diplomatic effort or even in terms of Palestinian politics. They've been paralyzed. So the last thing Israel wants is someone to emerge who could unify Palestinians, inspire the national movement, possibly even renew the national movement in some way. And so right now, Marwan Barghouti is the person who is most likely to do those things. And so they have to keep him from playing that role as, you know, emerging as a unifying leader.
Khaled Ogindi, you've said you're not concerned about Hamas trying to remain in power, but that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and his leadership will try to insinuate itself in Gaza and monopolize the conversation. If you can explain, and also, do you think part of why Netanyahu didn't attend the summit, though he was invited, was not to be seen with Mahmoud Abbas? Others said it was because the Turkish President Erdogan said he would turn his flight around and go back to Turkey if Netanyahu was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, sorry, the first part of your question
was what's going to happen? What is in the deal around Hamas control of Gaza?
Yeah, I think I think what's important is for Palestinians as a collective to discuss the future of Gaza. And that includes everything from rebuilding, governance, security, you know, the connection with the West Bank. All of those things are not up to any one particular party, not up to Hamas and not up to Mahmoud Abbas to pursue on their own. And I think Hamas made that clear when they accepted the Trump plan. When they talked about things like disarming or, you know, all of these other aspects, they couched it in the language of a Palestinian consensus. These are matters to be discussed internally. And I think that was wise. It's wise for Hamas because it gives them cover to be able to do those things. But it's also wise politically and I think necessary for Palestinians to rebuild their national movement. You cannot have. Right now, Mahmoud Abbas is deeply, deeply unpopular. So importing his very unpopular leadership into Gaza is not going to be very effective. You need to have a broad Palestinian consensus that can move forward together. And so that was the thrust of that point that I was making about not letting Mahmoud Abbas or really anyone monopolize the process. As far as Netanyahu... Yeah.
No, I just wanted to ask you, there have been reports that have emerged since the ceasefire that there have been armed clashes between Hamas and other groups within Gaza. What do we know about this? Of course, most Americans don't know that Hamas is not the only resistance force within Gaza.
Right. It's not the only resistance force. It's also not the only armed force. There are armed elements. There are criminal elements. There are tribal elements that are not political, but are pursuing narrow self-interests. And there are agents of chaos. There are people who seek to exploit the power vacuum that existed in Gaza and that still exists. For the last 2 years, we saw, for example, there are many groups that loot aid that was coming in. And in many cases, those criminal elements were at least provided some cover by the Israeli military. And so what Hamas says it's doing now is first is establishing some kind of law and order. In preventing chaos and lawlessness, which is, you know, something that is very normal when there is a power vacuum and when there is enormous death and destruction and despair and trauma. There are people who emerge who want to take advantage of that. So on the one hand, it is to prevent chaos. There is, I think, an element also of settling scores particularly with people who are seen as collaborators with Israel. They're not necessarily being tried and, receiving due process, but there is some kind of process that may not meet basic standards. But I think this is what Hamas is trying to do. I don't necessarily think that they are trying to hold on to power. I think they are trying to demonstrate that they are brokers and will be part of decision-making going forward, but not necessarily the sole governing authority as they were before October 7th.
Khaled El-Gindi, what about the fact that, Palestinians continue to be killed, at least five yesterday, by Israeli forces, apparently. What stops Israel from engaging in a full-scale assault, just moving back in, as happened before the last ceasefire?
Yeah, I think there's nothing that stops them. Barring, of course, the president of the United States. And we saw how that played out in March. The president gave Netanyahu basically a green light to destroy that ceasefire after the first phase. That may or may not happen this time. We don't know. My sense is that President Trump seems to be much more serious about it this time for his own calculations. This is typical of how Israel relates to a ceasefire. We saw this in Lebanon, where even today, almost a year after a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, Israel still acts more or less freely in Lebanon as it does in Syria and other places, and as it certainly will continue to do in Gaza. It will strike people wherever and whenever it feels it needs to. And the pattern has been, as long as it's not, on a massive scale, that will be tolerated. But that can also be ratcheted up gradually, right? It can be five over the last few days, and then that number can increase. And there is this kind of drip effect that desensitizes the international community, which has already stopped paying attention to the issue at this point. And so, but the plan doesn't have any restraints on Israel. There's no timetable for Israel to withdraw. So it's really up to the
Palestinian statehood, Khaled?
Sorry?
Any discussion of Palestinian statehood?
There's a lot of discussion
In the ceasefire hostage deal that was signed yesterday.
There is a reference to, in aspirational terms, about a Palestinian state, but it is not, there are no steps toward a state. We know that Israel completely rejects the idea of a Palestinian state. So it's not really on the table as part of this plan. In the way, let's say, that previous peace plans, like the 2003 roadmap, had very concrete steps that needed to be taken in order to reach a Palestinian state. Now it's merely stated as a Palestinian aspiration, but is not something that is a serious, part of.
Very quickly, the Arab and Muslim countries, their role, apparently Indonesia in rebuilding. Of course, there's Saudi Arabia. There's a meeting going now in Sussex in England about rebuilding. What is the role of Arab and Muslim countries also in what has been talked about as an international stabilization force?
Yeah, I think there is an expectation that Arab and Muslim countries are going to play a very large role in both of those, financing the reconstruction of Gaza, particularly the Arab Gulf states, of course, because they have considerable resources and a direct stake in the stability of the region. And they're also being talked about as candidates, to contribute forces in this international stabilization force. But we don't have clear commitments on either front. I think we're much more likely to see movement on pledges and, you know, donor assistance to, you know, contributing to a reconstruction fund of some kind. I think it will be much harder to convince countries to commit troops, at least until there is more clarity on what the mission or mandate of this force is going to be, under whose command, what sort of role are they going to play, what will be its relationship with the Israeli military. Because the last thing that any of these countries want to do is to be seen as an occupying power or as doing the dirty work of the current occupying power, which, of course, is Israel. So those are things that are going to be worked out over the medium term, I think.
Khaled El-Gindi, we want to thank you so much for being with us, visiting scholar at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah for permanent status negotiations. He's the author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. We've been trying to reach the Al Jazeera correspondent on the ground in Gaza City, but have been unable to as the internet is down. So we're going to end today's show with Juan, where he is right now in Chicago. On Saturday, the Chicago Teachers Union organized a protest dubbed Funds Not Feds outside the Chicago headquarters of Google. They're demanding an end to ICE raids and calling for federal funds to be redirected to schools, healthcare, food assistance, and violence prevention. This is Chicago alderperson Anthony Joel Quesada.
We're also here because we know what we're up against. Donald Trump and his fascist authoritarian administration are advancing an agenda built on fear and division. They are stripping away health care, food access, and housing from those who already struggle the most, like our elders and our working families. They are terrorizing our communities and kidnapping our neighbors. And while they take from the many, they reward the few.
So, Juan Gonzalez, there in Chicago, leading reporter, as usual, reporter extraordinaire. Talk about the latest in Chicago right now.
Well, Amy, the amazing thing that's happened over the last several weeks is this grassroots movement that has developed all around the city to protect immigrants from ICE raids. Late last week in the mostly Latino neighborhood of Belmont Cragen, there was a meeting called for community members to join a rapid response group. They were supposed to meet at a Mexican restaurant. Over 200 people showed up, so many people that they couldn't actually hold the meeting because people couldn't fit in to the restaurant to sit down and get their instructions. So they basically had to give out the literature. There have been meetings all around the city at college campuses and in neighborhoods to build this self-defense group at the same time that the political leaders are constantly on top of the issue, from the governor to the mayor to the local elected officials and alderpersons. The mayor, of course, issued an executive order not permitting any city-owned property to be used by ICE. So there is from the ground level up to the highest levels of political office in Illinois, a tremendous response and resistance to the Trump raids and to the threats of trying to bring in the military to Chicago.
Well, that does it for our show today, Juan. Thanks so much for that report. We end today's show by wishing Miguel Noguera a happy birthday and also a happy fifth birthday to my beloved Zazu Goodpup. She came to us in Nor'easter in 2020. I wish her brother, her beloved brother Kasha, a happy birthday as well. And thanks so much for joining us. I'll be speaking at the Lensic Theater in Santa Fe on October 17th, on Friday night, as they show the new film on Democracy Now! Called Steal This Story, Please! And then on Saturday and Sunday in Woodstock and Saugerties. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for BitCouver FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.